Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Here go. Let it bump, though.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you this time with Andy Bailey. We are going to keep our season preview train rolling. We're moving on to the Cleveland Cavaliers, which, what are we going to talk about with them, right? Nothing really happened this offseason. We are very excited to be joined by Fear the Sword news editor and staff writer, and also the co-host of the Chase Down podcast with Justin Rowan, Carter Rodriguez. How are you doing tonight, Carter?
I'm doing good. I heard you refer to Andy as Bales before we started, and I really like that, and I'm going to roll with that, I think, the rest of the way, if it's not too familiar.
I'm really annoyed that it hasn't caught on. I think I've been calling him Bales for like 3 years now.
I would like there to be some kind of backstory, like where he's just unreliable, you know, like
Bales. Even the last couple weeks of podcasting, that could be accurate.
Yeah, it might be. I don't even know how it came up, but Bales just sounded cool. So we
finally,
we found someone else that likes it. So I think that means that it has to be a nickname. We'll put it on his basketball reference page.
I think we can lock it in, and I've continued my long-running tradition of starting podcasts off-topic.
That's how we like it here. Tangents are
good.
Fun.
Good.
But to get on topic, we have the Cleveland Cavaliers, and Andy and I have been kind of like holding off on this preview for the longest time. We wanted to sync up and do it, but it just seemed like there was so much going on, and everything kept changing for a team that entered the summer with very little flexibility. They became a very fluid product. So to start off on this general point, how are you feeling in the aftermath of everything that's happened? Not just the Kyrie Irving trade and the return they got for it, but even the stuff that's come out about LeBron James perhaps being frustrated with the front office, about the Cavaliers being unable to trade for Butler or Paul George, about the Dan Gilbert continuing to just devalue his general managers, just kind of this all-encompassing initial impression. What did you have of it for their offseason?
Well, I mean, it's been a tire fire most of the way, right? Like, there's no other way to say it. And you have Griff getting fired, so that, like, that was a bummer. You have LeBron unhappy that Griff was fired. Okay, that's a bummer with the rumors of him, leaving to join the Lakers after this season, swirling. And then Kyrie demands a trade, which I just think everyone was blindsided by. And everything just seems to get worse and worse. Their big signing on the first day of free agency was Jose Calderon. And all of a sudden, you feel all right. Like, it's not that bad, the situation. Like, given where I think most of the fan base was at, which was, like, pretty much already at the point where, like, okay, they're going to get a really unfavorable return for Kyrie because look at the returns for the other stars that were traded in the last 9 months or so. And they're going to be worse. LeBron's going to leave, and Dan Gilbert's going to mismanage this team to hell until he sells the team or dies. That's what it looked like. And that's the way people felt, honestly. And all of a sudden, Kobe Altman, this rookie GM, makes a really, really good trade. And I guess to some extent the trade will ultimately be judged based on when Isaiah Thomas comes back and at what health. But when that Brooklyn pick got involved, all of a sudden there's just kind of this sense of like, oh, maybe they could work something out. And that really was not the sense for much of the season. I think, you know, no one's given this team an A for the offseason because it was a disaster in a lot of ways. But I think if you're a Cavs fan, after all the negative stuff happened, if I were to tell you that you would be feeling okay, I think that's a win given the shit storm. Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear. Given the crap storm that this team's been in. I think people feel okay. I think there's a little bit of, it's funny, the karma that the universe serves up. Cavs fans, including myself, by the way, spend all their time making fun of Jay Crowder and Isaiah Thomas, and then we are served with them as our hope, as our hope for the future.
I agree with almost everything you said there. It did seem like it was kind of chaotic until at the time the trade was first broke, I just thought, oh my gosh, Cleveland hit a home run. And even as more and more stories come out all over the internet, like, oh my gosh, Isaiah's hip is worse than we thought. And who knows if he'll even play until January or February. Even if he comes back that late and isn't quite himself, I think the worst this trade can get is like a solid double. I still think they got pretty good value based on the situation that they were in, with their back kind of against the in the corner because of a trade demand. Ultimately, I don't know how much of Eurobasket you've watched, but if they end up with Luka Doncic, man, that guy looks so good to me. So I'm with you. I think the return is really strong in this deal.
Yeah, I mean, you look at it from, and what's interesting is as more stuff leaks out about Isaiah's hip, it does make you wonder if maybe we just processed that whole Cavs renegotiation thing wrong. Because it's either worse than we thought, or it's as bad as Danny Ainge told the Cavs. You know, this has been such an interesting offseason in a lot of ways, because I would like to think that having covered this team for 3 years now, and having followed them my whole life, you know, you get pretty good at figuring out what stories are legitimate and kind of figure out who's at the root of, you know, who's which sources are aligned with which journalist. You kind of just figure that out over time, right? And with almost everything that's happened this summer, I have no clue what the truth is.
Yeah, like, it's tough to find like the common thread through all the Isaiah stories.
Yeah, or even with the David Griffin stories, or even with the LeBron Kyrie stories.
Yeah,
what their rift is and what Kyrie's motivation was. You have all these different genuinely reputable journalists coming out and saying completely different stuff. It's been just mind-boggling trying to sort through. And I mean, from my perspective, it's just been really confusing, because you kind of just have to pick whatever, like, it's a really ugly thing, because with this offseason, I feel like you just had to pick whatever narrative you like best, because you can find a good journalist that'll support you.
That's like basically any LeBron team in a nutshell in the offseason, it feels like.
I was going to ask if there's any sense of relief if he does leave, to not be surrounded by all that kind of drama.
I think if anyone tells you that, like, Justin Rowan, my esteemed co-host, has kind of hinted at that in the past.
I think that may be where I got it from, actually.
Yeah, I think it's all a coping mechanism, to be honest, when people say that. Like, it's way fun to have LeBron on your team. Like, if you haven't, you should try it. It's great. Like, your team's always interesting. Yeah, it's tiring, but, like, how tiring is it? It's basketball. Like, come on.
And no matter how dramatic it is, you're going to be in the finals every year. So
yeah, so it's fun. You get to watch really, really good basketball, even though sometimes I think people pretend the Cavs don't play good basketball. And it's like, no, they're really, really good. They don't just out-talent everyone. They make a lot of sense as a roster, even if it doesn't kind of fit what you like. And they run good actions when they run them. So I don't know. I don't think I'd feel relieved. Am I going to be heartbroken like I was when I was 18 when LeBron left the first time? No, because I'm an adult now. You know, I've had my heart broken, and now I just know, you know, I'll be bummed for a minute, and then I'll get over it because it's just basketball. But you know, I don't think a sense of relief. I think anyone who's selling a sense of relief, forgets how little fun it is to suck at basketball, and B is probably subconsciously trying to cope.
Well, and the other thing is with this Nets pick, it doesn't really have to be a matter of are we relieved or are we worried. It better equips the Cavs, and I would think the view from their fans, to just go with the flow. You know, if LeBron comes back, now you have this incredible trade chip that could land you another impact player or two. And if he does leave, you know, we still have Seti and we have this draft pick and we still have the best contract in the NBA with Jay Crowder. And even the Isaiah Thomas situation, we talk about him in the context of being healthy, how there's a very good chance that he would be a lateral move from Kyrie Irving on offense, if not close to it.
He might even be better on offense.
It's tough for me to believe that he would necessarily replicate the past two seasons. That was one of my, like, arguments for maybe the Celtics would regress no matter what, just because he was so good these past 2 years. But let's look at this injury. You know, if he doesn't play for a half season, that might not be the worst thing in the world, because the point guard market is still oversaturated at the starting position. He's been talking about getting max money. If you're going to get him for a lot cheaper than he expected to sign for, or a lot cheaper than some other starting point guards in the league, now you've also kind of created that flexibility. And so I still think there's a possibility the Cavs will be better off both in the short and long term. But the fact that this flexibility exists at all would say to me, if I was a Cavs fan, yeah, whatever happens, happens. This organization, Dan Gilbert, is this terrible overlord, but we're at least equipped, it looks like, on paper, to handle whatever scenario much better than we were a couple months ago.
Yeah, I mean, and that's just kind of I don't think if Kyrie Irving had never made this trade request, we'd be having this conversation, I don't think the Cavs would have ever done that deal without their backs pushed up against the wall. But since it's there, yeah, it's certainly interesting. And then you look at the fact that we all know that there's a free agency bubble that's burst. There's not a lot, like half the leagues to be in the luxury tax. And there's not that same cultural narrative momentum for the Cavs to pay Thomas as there would have been with the Celtics. Right? Like, I'm not crazy in saying that.
No, that's like, definitely true.
The Celtics had a lot more pressure to pay him based on results. I don't know a lot in this world, but I'm pretty sure Isaiah Thomas is not going to be fifth in the MVP voting this year, even if he played all year. Yeah. It's just like your value kind of depresses at this point.
Yeah, sorry. They were under even more pressure to pay him, too, because not only was he valuable to them, but you went and you traded away the right to draft Markelle Fultz.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah, it's just a really interesting scenario. And then, I mean, the Cavs just have so many options. Like, this pick, even if if it lands high, and here's the question, and this is terrible, terrible radio, but if this lottery reform passes to flatten the top three picks, does that go into effect this upcoming draft?
2019.
Okay, yeah. 2019. Okay, because I was about to say, if it does, Jesus, that Nets pick looks even more valuable. Because they're almost certainly not going to have the worst record, even if they are not good again. But I guess never mind.
I think it's. I'm kind of fascinated by how many people are dismissing their chance to have the worst record. Actually.
Yeah, dude.
I think they're still very much in the conversation. There's been a lot of pro Boston writers that are like, "Oh, it's just going to be six or seven.
Yeah, so speaking of coping, anyway.
That's just what they're just reading off Danny and just. Talking points on the email chain.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God.
I think that's very much in play that's the number one pick. Yeah, I mean,
you look at that roster and they have a lot of problems still. And I mean, Timofey Mozgov is going to be their starting center. They're going to have a Jeremy Lin, D'Angelo Russell backcourt, which is going to surrender probably 190 points for 100 possessions. I have a theory that I think the basketball intelligentsia is overrating the Nets a little bit. And I am too, in the sense that I just think we all want to see them do well because they're being run really well right now. And we know what a bad hand they were dealt, this current organization was dealt. So I just think we inherently say, oh, they're making smart moves, so they're going to be better. But like, you don't jump. I think they're over under. Was at like 28.5 to start the season. They won 20 games last year. You don't jump 8.5 games because you added D'Angelo Russell while losing your best player.
Yeah.
That's an enormous leap. So
that's a good way to summarize it. I think that they're very well run, and I agree with you there. And I think a lot of these moves are good long-term moves.
Sure.
But it's kind of crazy to say that in a vacuum, D'Angelo Russell for Brook Lopez is going to make you better right now. Like, that's just kind of hard for me to buy.
Especially when you already had one of your best players that's best in that role that he's going to play. Like, there's going to be some redundancy there. So, anyway, this isn't a Nets podcast. The point is, I think the Cavs do have a lot of flexibility here. And I think they could even, if LeBron decides to stick around, if they show out in the finals, they might just keep the pick. I mean, one thing that I think we are kind of underrating when we're talking about the Cavs' current roster construction is this whole thing was kind of built in the last 3 years to say, as LeBron James fades, this young star point guard, Kyrie Irving, is going to rise, right? there isn't that young star to rise anymore. They're a team for the now, more than they've ever been, even though they, in terms of their actual players, other than Chetty Osmond. So there's a real chance, like, if Michael Porter is there, they might just take him, right? If there's not a really good trade on the market. So I just think they have a lot of options, and they're able to cope. And when this trade went down, I wrote something along the lines of that the worst part about losing a superstar is the first year, because your record was good the year before. You're not getting a top rookie. You're going to be bad with nothing to build towards. You're just burning a year. That's what the Bulls are doing. They're burning a year. Sure, Markkanen was the seventh pick, but they're not getting a, they didn't get a blue chipper, right? The Cavs are now set up where if the worst possible thing happens, there's at least something to look forward to next year. And I think that, as a fan of the team and for that fan base, that's kind of invaluable.
I completely agree with you there. And what I think what we can't forget either, too, is even when you're looking at them specifically in the now, it's so easy to kind of downplay their roster because we're evaluating everything they do closely to what the Warriors have, more so than any other team in the league still. It's just, you look at this Cavs roster, and we talk about Kevin Love as a liability. Kevin Love's a liability against maybe one or two teams in the league right now, and one of them just happens to be the Warriors. And the Cavaliers is, I guess, I don't want to use the word inability, but maybe reluctance, or how they're ill-equipped to match a death squad lineup unless they're prepared to throw LeBron at center. Like, that's a concern basically for only the Warriors. This team is still, if Isaiah Thomas doesn't play for half the year, if Isaiah Thomas doesn't play at all, they're still just going to steamroll the rest of the Eastern Conference. So if you're going to go out and then all of a sudden trigger this rebuild, you might as well do it, go off with a bang with a fourth straight NBA Finals appearance. And it's just so funny how much of that still gets lost because you have LeBron James, and because of how the league and the NBA Finals have unfolded the past 3 years, it's, oh, but they're not the Warriors. They didn't do this to get the Warriors. And it was the same thing with the Paul George, Jimmy Butler trades. Those situations seems like they were squandered, but the Cavaliers, given their situation, their lack of flexibility, their lack of trade chips, you're not supposed to go out and get players like that. But because they have to be viewed in this vacuum with the Warriors, everything they do that's geared toward the now, or everything that we do when we're trying to project what happens next season, just doesn't seem to hold as much flash anymore.
Yeah, what's funny about you saying that is, like, every now and again I'll see someone talk about the Cavs, like, kind of exorbitant payroll, and say, oh, you know, they mismanaged, they have no flexibility or whatever. And it's like, well, no, this is just like a CBA that's functioning properly. The Cavs shouldn't be able to go add another max guy. They're ridiculously good. Like, just because the Warriors were able to add Kevin Durant due to one of the all-time weirdest series of events, doesn't mean that the Cavs should just be able to do the same. Like, they really shouldn't be, like, in any normal world. Like, I thought that Cavs team last year, in terms of the way they played in the postseason, like, they were one of the most talented teams we've ever seen. They just played maybe the most talented team we've ever seen. And that,
in a lot of years, they would have won the title.
I think almost every year. They were amazing.
Yeah. I want to switch gears a little bit. We've talked about the trade and the future a lot. I'm really curious to hear a Cleveland expert's take on Kevin Love. 13-14, his last season in Minnesota, he was third in the entire NBA in both player efficiency rating and box plus minus. He was fourth in win shares per 48 minutes. He was arguably a top five player in the league that season. I'm really curious to see what he looks like as the clear number two for at least the first couple of months before Isaiah comes back, and probably afterward if Isaiah is not the same guy he was last season. This is maybe the most intriguing storyline to me for Cleveland. What is the LeBron Kevin Love 1-2 punch look like?
I think I'm gonna bum you out, Andy, because I think we've done this song and dance before, and Kyrie has missed time before, and Tyronn Lue has talked a big game about, oh, we're gonna get Kevin his elbow touches again, and we're going to feature him more, and he's going to be great for us. And to be clear, he is great for them. He's really, really good. LeBron and Kevin Love lineups with Kyrie off the floor outscored teams by 15 points per 100 possessions. That being said, this is an offense that the way the Cavs should design their offense is a really interesting debate to me, because a lot of people say, oh, look at what Boston does, or look at what these other systems do that produce a ton of points and look really nice. Why can't the Cavs do that? And my answer is, the Cavs offense is better than those teams. What they do works really, really well. They're a top three offense in the league every year. And really what their offense functionally is leveraging literally everything they do around LeBron's strengths. And unless LeBron is willing to cede some of that control, because, I mean, if you look at LeBron's shot chart and where he likes to hold the ball, it's all on the left elbow and left wing. Guess where Kevin Love likes to hang out?
Yeah.
The left elbow and the left wing. So he's got to cede control of the offense to Love to make that happen, and they have to kind of – they really have to change fundamentally what they do. And, I mean, that's what – Zach Lowe is reporting that they're redesigning their offense to feature him more, but I'm just kind of at the point where I'm going to have to see it to believe it, because, you know, a lot of people are – you know, have told me, oh, well, Lou has no choice now but to feature Love. And I was like, in lineups with – in bench units with just Love and Kyrie and LeBron both sitting, I saw a lot of Delly Tristan Thompson pick and rolls. like this is not – this has been a long-running thing. And what my question has always been is that are we conflating what's best for Kevin Love's offense and efficiency for what's best for the Cleveland Cavaliers' offense and efficiency? Because those aren't one and the same necessarily.
Is this even about efficiency? This seems more about ego, because he's still going to put up points by playing the role that he's been playing. You're going to get a ton of wide-open catch-and-shoot looks with LeBron. And as Lowe pointed out, some of this other stuff without Irving soaking up as many touches, maybe he'll get more rolls to the basket. And, yes, maybe there'll be a little wiggle room for some more elbow touches. But offense isn't the issue, and Lowe pointed this out too, so I don't want to make it seem like we're just quoting his article word for word. Kevin Love's defense is the problem. So unless you're going to rework the defense or rework Kevin Love's defense to make that a better fit to where you can survive with him at center against more of these Western Conference teams, because there's not really an Eastern Conference team that'll worry you in those lineups, that seemed like all this talk about, well, we need to rework the offense, or we're doing this, Kevin Love's going to be more involved. Kevin Love doesn't need to be more involved. And I'm talking about for his own sake too. The numbers will still be there. He put up good numbers last year. So it's just, and now he's the number two option until Isaiah comes back. So those numbers will just go up by default. It just seems like we're kind of moving these goalposts at this point when we're talking about the need to reinvent any part of Cleveland's offense.
Yeah, that's kind of what I've always gone to. And this is something that our former editor at Fear the Sword, David Zavak, always, you know, this is his big Kyrie bit, is like, you kind of make the argument, oh, Kyrie needs to move the ball more. And he'd always just say, why? Their offense is really, really good when he plays. And it's like, it's a simplistic argument, and obviously he would get into it a little deeper, but like ultimately, like, that matters, right? That they're really, 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 really good on offense. And I'll hesitate to say that Love's defense is a problem against almost anyone but the Warriors. I'm more than comfortable with him at center if I'm the Cavs against any other team in the league. I really am. And honestly, defensively, he plays center. They put Tristan Thompson on the range here, guys, more often than not. They don't want Love chasing people around on the perimeter, and that's what modern fours do. So I don't know. I just think that I think Love's going to play almost the same role he's played, maybe with a slightly higher usage. And a lot of this is just empty talk, which, sorry, Andy, I don't think we're getting our Minnesota love back.
I'll end this segment by saying I will laugh at both of you when Cleveland runs a couple of elbow drop-offs from Love to LeBron, like Jokic to Gary Harris.
Well, it'll be the first
it'll
be the first three possessions of the game, and then they'll never do it again.
Maybe I'm putting too much trust in Tyronn Lue to get a little bit more creative. But yeah, I think you're right. And speaking of Kevin Love at center lineups, how would you flesh out the rest of that five? Obviously now, I think this is kind of an underrated part of the trade is getting Jay Crowder. And we've talked a little bit about how Cleveland, they're fine against every team in the league but the Warriors. But this is a guy that I think helps them a little bit against the Warriors. I don't think I would be ready to say that they're like on an even par with Golden State yet, but at least this is one more wing that can guard like two or three or four positions.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's the thing that was really funny after this trade came out to me is that a lot of people wrote articles that said, hey, Jay Crowder's probably going to help a little bit on Kevin Durant. And then, of course, you have those assholes over in Warriors Twitter that are like, huh, KD stopper? I don't think so. And it's like, there's a huge difference between KD stopper and Richard Jefferson on an island.
Yeah. That's, like, that's a great point.
Like, you don't have to make KD shoot like 20% from the field. He just has to not shoot 70% from the field. And the series looks a lot closer.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's like, absolutely true. I think there's a monumental jump from those minutes to what Jay Crowder can possibly provide.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. And I don't want to take it too far out of the spirit of the segment, but Tyronn Lue's got a really interesting rotation to figure out right now. Because this team probably could use a 3-for-1 trade. I don't think anyone really expected the Cavs to get three players back for Kyrie.
Yeah.
So you look at their rotation right now. They got Thomas and Rose at the point guard. They've got JR and Korver at shooting guard. They've got LeBron and Crowder at the three. But Crowder's going to have to play every single backup 4 minute because LeBron plays too many minutes. You can't just put Crowder in for 11 minutes, you know? So he's going to have to play almost every single backup 4 minute just to get to, like, 28 or 30. And then you've got Thompson and Fry at the five, and it's like, you hear rumors that Dwayne Wade might come midseason. It's like, who the hell's sitting?
Yeah,
that's a good question.
Is there any chance that Tyronn Lue is, like, basketball progressive enough to play without a point guard?
Yeah.
Like, without a traditional point guard?
I mean, if Derrick Rose ends up being your only option for the first part of the season, I think you'll become progressive.
Excuse me, Jose Calderon might listen to that.
Sorry to make that aside, but why was he signed 10 seconds into free agency? The Jose Calderon deal was just so overwhelmingly random and stupid.
Was that while Griffin was kind of in limbo?
No, that was after.
That was him? Or that was after he was gone?
That was Altman's first move. And I was like, oh, we got a lemon here. And then
he's not that
one of the best superstar trades that we've ever seen. So it's like, all right, Kobe, we'll give you a pass for Calderon. But yeah, so
he's like Kobe Bryant.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Lue is for any detractions he has, he's not afraid to mess with lineups. And he's not afraid to hurt egos either. I mean, if you look at the game 3 against the Pacers in the playoffs last year when they were down like 27 and LeBron led them back for a win. Kyrie and Love's asses were playing on the bench the entire third and fourth quarters. He didn't play it. He was just like, yeah, sorry, you're not bringing it. You're out. This guy's, if he's anything, he's really, really confident in making decisions. He's not really afraid to make those big swings. I mean, hell, he played LeBron at center a decent amount in the finals, and he's played JR and Shump as nominal point guards. And obviously, I don't think Shump's going to play this year, which will be every Cavs fan's dream to hear.
I was going
to
say, Cavs Twitter is very down on Shump.
Well, that's because he's not very good at basketball.
The idea of LeBron with four other wings is really intriguing to me.
Yeah, I think that's like the ultimate switchy doom. But I mean, the thing is, like, I actually really like LeBron at the four next to Tristan if we're building the most optimal defensive lineup, because that guy can switch, he can rebound, he can defend the post, and he's actually a really good roll man on the pick and roll percentage. I don't have the percentiles in front of me, but he has learned to finish as a roll man, and he knows his limitations on that end. Plus, if the team does have you spread out and stretched at every other position, a one-on-one battle for an offensive rebound, Tristan Thompson is going to win more often than not.
Yeah, and that would be a luxury that sort of death lineup would have that a lot of others don't. Because a lot of times when you go small, you think, okay, I'm sacrificing rebounding for switchability and speed, and they wouldn't necessarily have to do that if they kept Tristan Thompson in our lineup. So I think I would probably agree with you there.
Yeah, I mean, Tristan, it's funny, like, Tristan's the guy that I think Cavs fans are so much higher on than everyone else. And I think it's because deep down, I think they know that this is his most optimal deployment. Like, everyone else kind of sees his limitations and sees, like, oh, if he were on any other team, he wouldn't have the impact he does. But it's like, the Cavs just really need him to do the stuff he does, and there's no one else on the team equipped to do the things he does well better, other than probably just LeBron, who you really don't want to be having doing garbage work and burning himself out guarding centers. So, yeah, Tristan's a really, really important piece for this team, and I think that that will be something that Cavs fans really feel it more than anyone else because they feel his absence when he's not out there when you're watching them over an 82-game schedule.
Yeah. Well, I have a soft spot for him because my one of my college coaches called me into his office one time and said I was the garbage man on the team. So,
hell yeah.
I've got a soft spot for anybody who plays like that. But anyway, go ahead, Dan.
Oh, no, I was just going to say I did agree with that. And it's not an ideal matchup, but when you talk about who Tristan Thompson needs to guard as that five in those smaller lineups, Tristan Thompson against Draymond Green, yes, it's a mismatch, but it's just not the worst mismatch when you're strictly looking at Tristan Thompson's defense. Things might get a little murky because Thompson may allow Green to roam a little bit more on the defensive end himself, or it's a player that the Warriors are able to stash one of their other wings on. But defensively, Carter was spot on there. It is probably Cleveland's best option with that five. And I don't think the gap between Thompson guarding Draymond Green is really going to be that much larger than it would be if you're trying to stick LeBron at the five and have him guard Draymond almost full time.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, this is a big Justin Rowan observation that I feel like not enough people have talked about, is one of the reasons Tristan had such a tough finals is that he had to guard Draymond Green full time because LeBron had to guard Durant full time. Guess who doesn't have to guard Durant full time anymore? You can put Jay Crowder on Durant and say, hey, go do your best, sport, and then put LeBron on Draymond and then just stash Tristan on. You have a lot more opportunities to get creative after this trade defensively, where if Livingston's out there, I guarantee you they're gonna put Tristan on him and say, go defend the rim and rebound. Because I think Draymond kind of got him out of his game by forcing him to float so far out so consistently.
What are kind of the question marks for this team beyond Isaiah Thomas's health now? Is it looks like the starting five will be easy to hammer out, and then the sixth man, that's easy as well. But when you're going deeper into the roster, like, what are you looking to see? Is there someone who just needs to pop? And I guess you can't even really say that because they don't have, as you mentioned before, these players with upside. So when you say we're looking for someone to really burst, it's going to be a Jeff Green or it's going to be a Derrick Rose. So it's just they're in a weird situation when you move beyond those first six, maybe seven players.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of question marks, Derrick Rose's fit with LeBron is going to be really interesting. And we know that, like, Derrick Rose is at this point in his career where he's now gotten to the point where he's very divisive, I think it's fair to say. A lot of people think he is just not a rotational player anymore. But he does have these very clear outlined strengths, but then obviously very clear outlined weaknesses. Like, there's just no, he's like a player of extremes. There's nothing that's just okay about him. He's either really good at this one thing or just trash, dumpster fire bad. And seeing the Cavs try to figure out a way to leverage the good while mitigating the bad, I think is going to be really fascinating. We know he can still get to the rim. I'm interested to see how much they try to use him and LeBron as pick and roll partners. Because LeBron operates out of that short roll really well, and Rose still, if he's good at anything, it's getting to the basket. And I think he can force those switches and those destabilizations that come with LeBron as the screener. But that's going to mean LeBron has to be the screener, something he's sometimes a little hesitant to do in the regular season.
That's pretty interesting. For some reason, I hadn't thought of the idea of a Derrick Rose, LeBron James pick and roll. It's kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, go ahead.
You can get downhill with LeBron as your screener because he gets he has such gravity as the role man. And it'll be a little different than a Kyrie LeBron pick and roll, where Kyrie forces the switch, then dances for a little bit. Like, yeah. I think he'll be able to turn the corner and get to the rim really quick, and it'll be up to him to, you know, not be an idiot and distribute the ball well to wide open shooters that are, that'll dot the perimeter. And, you know, ideally he'll try on defense. I think we're pretty much past the point where we're counting on that, right, to be a decent defender. But I don't think he's going to be a lot worse than Kyrie was. So it'll be interesting to see what he does, and I'm really interested to see what he looks like once Thomas comes back, because Lou is all of a sudden in a really weird spot, because if he's playing Isaiah Thomas, even a low, like, 34 minutes a game, is Derrick Rose going to be okay at 14 minutes a game? Because I don't think you can ever play him with Thomas. That'd be a defensive nightmare. So all of a sudden, like, you're just going to have a lot of egos getting checked on this roster, because they've got too many players right now.
Yeah, and
what if Derek, go ahead, Dan.
Derrick Rose signed. He signed amid all like the Kyrie Irving stuff, right? Like that was it. He wasn't. Kyrie Irving was still on the team when he signed, but the trade rumor was known, so he might have put pen to paper kind of under the guise that, oh, I'll still be able to get, even if I'm coming off the bench, like 25 minutes or something. If he did sign before the Irving trade rumors comes out, it's, oh, well, he kind of knew what he was getting into anyway. But now, that is an interesting dynamic with Thomas. I didn't even think about that. I thought about his fit next to LeBron, about whether LeBron can turn him or Jeff Green into even a close to league average shooter off the ball. That would probably be one of the best achievements of his entire career if that happened. But the Derrick Rose thing, I don't, if the Cavaliers make him a rotation player again, or if he even appears to be of average value or above average value, that'll really be something. And at least, regardless of how many minutes he plays, this is the role that I think even Derrick Rose pessimists wanted for him. Let's see how he works as that guy who just comes off the bench and attacks second units. But we need, obviously, Isaiah Thomas to be healthy for that to happen. And I think almost this injury to Thomas could do a slight disservice to him, because maybe he won't get, if this turns into a season-long issue or if Isaiah's on this minutes cap, I think Rose needs to be against these second stringers, or needs to be in that sort of small burst role, so that he can still have value in today's NBA. Because you said the only thing he does really well right now is get to the rim. He doesn't even shoot that well around the rim because his release points are so bizarre. It's hard for him to draw fouls and just get these quality looks, and his takeoff points are weird. So he needs this, I think. And if Thomas isn't ready to rock for a good part of the season, I think that's actually going to do a big disservice to his value, individual value, to this Cavaliers team.
It's really an interesting dynamic. And, like, I just feel like the Wade thing is just looming. Like, if Wade gets bought out and he wants to go to Cleveland, they will sign him.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, that throws that rotation into even more of a logjam.
No, you buy out Derrick Rose and you use Wade.
I bet Derrick Rose gets bought out if this happens, because you just can't carry that, all that, and Wade would just become your de facto backup point guard.
How long is Calderon's deal?
1 year. But you can't.
So
you're
going to buy out Rose before him?
Yeah, because I think Rose would become a problem.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Calderon will not be a problem.
Yeah, he's not going to put up a fuss. That's a good point.
Calderon cannot believe he's still in the league and got paid just not to play for the Warriors last year.
That was amazing.
So, this guy is just banking it right now. So, it's just a really interesting. I really think the Cavs should still be pursuing a 3-for-1 trade. I think one of the details that has not been talked about enough over the course of this offseason for the Cavs is that by acquiring that Brooklyn pick, they're now allowed to trade their own 2018 first. And there's value there. Like, you can flip, if you can flip some salary and in Iman Shumpert, in Channing Frye, and in Richard Jefferson, you can get to $20 million in matching salary.
The weird point would be, because I would tell you right now, that's a great point that I hadn't even given much thought to, because right now they could probably kick around the tires on like a Kent Bazemore or a Wesley Matthews deal with that type of package, and either of those guys would be good for this team. But when LeBron kind of has you in limbo, do you want to make that commitment? Wesley Matthews would be interesting because he only has a maximum of 2 years left on his deal. So if LeBron James leaves and we're going to assume he opts in, you eat it for a season. So that might be an interesting deal that they could pursue, because it still seems like they need that extra guaranteed hustle on the wing, because some people think Shumpert provides it. It's definitely not consistent enough on defense. Yeah, and he turns into Andre Roberson when he's shooting threes sometimes. It's so bizarre. J.R. Smith, he played out of his mind sometimes defensively during that 2016 playoff run, but you're not going to get these plus contributions from him. Chetty Osman, I don't really know how much they're going to use him. I'm in love with him, though, so that'd be interesting. So if you can go out and kind of turn those salaries into another wing, that is probably the play.
You're not going to like hearing this, guys, but if the Melo situation continues to get ugly and uglier and uglier, and maybe he doesn't report to camp and he still says he'll only go to two teams, a salary dump in a late first might be the best the Knicks are getting.
I don't know who thinks they're getting more.
That's my point. And if the Cavs are in full LeBron retention mode, I think they're going to still kick the tires on a 3 or a 4 for 1 to go chase Melo. And this is something that I've talked about, that even though Melo, we all know he's got his huge problems, like the Cavs, the biggest key to beating the Warriors, other than not giving up 170 points per 100 possessions, is you need bucket getters, because acute offense doesn't work against their defense. They're too good. They're too smart. They're too switchy. They're too fast. You need someone like Kyrie to just get some bullshit, like, to go in. Like, to use an uncharitable term. And if they can't survive with Isaiah Thomas defensively, they might need one more volume scorer. So even though it would be a sexy pick and a PR kind of trade for the Cavs and please don't leave us LeBron kind of trade, there might be some utility there. I just think if that gets uglier and uglier, they're going to kick the tires. They can make that trade happen tomorrow if the Knicks decide they want to sell them. They can sell a salary dump and a first rounder to their fan base. It's interesting to see what the value is going to be.
How would Cavs fans feel if I brought this up like 2 years ago, probably, or maybe a year ago, the possibility of Tristan Thompson being involved in a Melo trade? Is that still just insane?
Yeah, Thompson's better than Melo now.
I mean, what if you're in that all-out retain LeBron mode that you just talked about?
I don't think you need to give it up. I think you have the upper hand here on the Knicks, because I think at this point we've kind of figured out that the Rockets just can't get a workable deal without Ryan Anderson then, and the Knicks aren't taking Ryan Anderson because that's an albatross.
See, I'm at the point where I think that Melo situation is not ever going to get resolved. He's just going to enter free agency next year.
That's interesting.
Think he's going to leave $27.9 million on the table?
No, yeah, he's opting in.
Well,
man.
Yeah, that's a good point, too.
Maybe an opt-in and a buyout the year after? That's a long time to be in limbo. With Porzingis getting more and more disinterested by the day.
Yeah, I think there's a chance that he would opt out because...
No way.
Some team would probably still give him four and 40.
Could you imagine if he goes? I think the fact that he's not, that we're hearing, obviously, I think Houston is probably the better situation for him, but
yes,
that he's pinned it down to this one team at this point, and we assume that Cleveland would still be in play if they wanted to really pony up the first-round pick and the salaries to get him, or if the Knicks are ready to lower whatever their asking price might be. If he doesn't go, the fact, again, that he just pinned it down to this one team, what does that kind of say about LeBron's future in Cleveland? Because the last thing you want to do if you're Melo,
yeah,
if you're planning on opting in because you know it's going to take you probably on next year's market at least 3 years to recoup all that money, you're not going to want to go to Cleveland and opt in to a team that doesn't have LeBron anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's obviously would prefer to go to Houston, but if it's between Cleveland, because if Houston just can't make a deal happen, I think he'll go to Cleveland if that's his alternative, and at least it'll be up to him. And he can opt in and take a buyout.
Lay out the expiring contracts, that's what you're saying, right?
Yeah,
Cleveland has enough money to send that is expiring.
So the only non-expiring deal is Shump, who has a player option. But I read a report. I think it was a Woj report from from 6 months ago. So bear in mind, it might be dated, and I might be missourcing. But I saw something along the lines of that someone reported that people around the league thought Shump might opt out by just overvaluing his value on the free market, which sounds like a very Iman Shumpert thing to do. But he does have 2 years, $20 million left on his deal. But everyone else, Fry is expiring. They would have to send Richard Jefferson, who has one more year expiring, but he has 2 years left, but the second year is unguaranteed. They have Eddie Tavares and Kay Felder, who are both unguaranteed. So that's for this year. So basically,
they'd be on the hook for $10 million for Shumpert.
Yeah, and that's at the worst case scenario if he does opt in.
Yeah, I guess that, now that you lay it out that does make some sense to me.
Yeah, it's
like they just want to get out from under that Mello deal.
And in at least as a front office, from a PR perspective, because I think we underrate how much that PR, how much selling the move to the public matters.
Yeah.
You can say, hey, we were in a really bad spot here, but we, and our cap looked terrible, but we shed a ton of long-term salary, and we got a first-round pick. Now, the press release isn't going to say that first-round pick is going to be 26th, but it's at least an easier sell than just saying, here's a straight salary dumper. Hey, we just bought him out.
Yeah, that actually does make some sense to me.
The only thing that would just make me uneasy is you're kind of steering into, it seems, just the all-offense model with Mello. So that's.
But you're not really giving up any rotation. The only rotation player you're giving up in this dump would be Fry, who can't play against the Warriors anyway.
One thing about Mello, too, it is all-offense kind of a move, but if he's playing the four, he's more switchable than Kevin Love is.
Sure. And he's not.
I mean, he can. He's not going to guard
defensively.
And
he's
not going to guard wings well, but at least he can kind of do it.
And he gets up against certain players. You could just tell. I would never even say that he'd be an average defender or someone that you want to toss on even Klay Thompson necessarily, or let alone Kevin Durant or even Draymond Green. But when he's facing, you can see it when he goes up against LeBron. You can see it when he goes up. Is switched on to Wade or something. You can see it when he goes up against Jimmy Butler for a possession or two at a time. He just locks in, and he's not obviously a good defender, but it's just a different mindset. And maybe when he's playing in meaningful games again, particularly the NBA Finals, that it kind of triggers that sort of J.R. Smith about face we saw a couple years ago where it's like, hey, he's not terrible right now.
Yeah. So I think
he could find that zone more consistently if he's playing alongside LeBron.
You would think. I mean, obviously, it's not a magic elixir, and the more casual fans would think that there's no chance they'd lose after. And I don't think they'd be. I don't think anyone would say they're better than Golden State after that move. But
no.
If the cost is the 26th pick of the 2018 draft, Channing Frye and Iman Shumpert and a couple rookies, come on.
Yeah. So let's just assume. Even if you want to bake in the fact that Wade is probably coming at some point midseason, but just looking at this roster as it is now, what's your floor? What's your pessimistic projection for this team, and what's your optimistic projection for them? Just relative to win totals, and I guess where they'll stand in the East, but that's a pretty given at this point.
I think their floor is about 50, and their ceiling is about 57, 58. I think that with these good teams. I think we're understating the way they're stretching out the schedule and the way that they're avoiding back-to-backs. I saw the Cavs have the fewest back-to-backs in the NBA this season. And I think that the top-heavy teams are going to skew higher. The overs for the top teams in the league are going to be a really good bet this year, even though it's normally not a good bet. Because there's going to be way less schedule losses than we're used to with the season starting 2-3 weeks earlier. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that makes sense. I would think so.
How many games can you fade a really, really good team as a gambler when you just know it's their fourth game in five nights or their first game home after a 7-game road trip? There's just easy gambling angles that are really going to get chopped up a little bit, and I think favorites are going to do a lot better than we're used to seeing because of that.
There you go. Betting advice added in with a record projection for all the gamblers out there.
I'm a half degenerate. I'm not a real degenerate, but I'm almost there.
You're no
Where do
Craig
you have
Hart.
Him, Dan?
I would say I like his ceiling for them. I think they're going to end up about 50, 54-55 because the East is a mess. I am not high on the Celtics or the Raptors at all this year. We do still have to take into account, I guess, with the less rest for LeBron, we're assuming that he's going to play more games, or maybe he'll go harder because he has more rest overall, that they jump and make this huge leap into the late 50s. I think I'm a little bit more pessimistic when it comes to their floor. Not necessarily the odds of them reaching it, but I could kind of see them almost finishing with under 50 victories somehow. Like, if you don't get Isaiah Thomas back until January, February, and he comes back and he's not the same, and LeBron and Derrick Rose just never forge any kind of chemistry, and he's forced to shoulder an even heavier burden than he has been since he came back. I could honestly see them ending up at, let's say, 48-49, which is not a disaster scenario because they don't give two craps about playoff seeds, but I could see things still going sideways for them. That being said, if you're going to tell me they get a half season of a healthy Isaiah Thomas, I would bet that they would end up with, I'm going to say 55 would be my guess for them then.
I'm going to say floor is mid-50s.
What?
I'm really? Higher than both of you guys.
Whoa!
Yeah.
I didn't know we were drinking during this podcast.
Go ahead and put the money on that over. I think they're, what's their total at, 53.5?
LeBron is going to be, I think he's going to be in rare form this season. I do think Kevin Love is going to get a fairly significant bump. I think Jay Crowder helps a ton. If Isaiah Thomas is like his old self in January, that's huge. And I'm fairly confident, even though LeBron hasn't really cared about the regular season in almost a decade, I'm pretty sure they're going to finish first.
That's fine, but to have their floor at the mid-50s just feels like incredible.
And I would add, too, what you said about the East. I think they're going to beat up on some terrible teams.
We didn't touch on that either, what you said, Bailey. Like, LeBron is going to be – like, he might be chasing –
I think he's going to be amazing.
Yeah, that, I didn't
– I think seeing all of the attention that James Harden and Russell Westbrook got for, like, just completely – hijacking their team's offenses, I think he might think, I know I can do that, and I know I can do it more efficiently than those guys.
You know, it's
so
funny.
I think we could see a crazy year from him.
Well, you know what I can guarantee for this season for the Cavaliers? They're going to lose every single game to the Nets that they play just to drive the fan bonkers.
They're going to soak up whatever fines Adam Silver is going to levy. Just, they're going to bench everybody just to let
No, them. I'm saying they're, yeah, they're, well, no, they, I mean, they want to beat the Nets from an incentive standpoint, and they're going to lose just because I know how this team works. And even when things are great, they'll still drive you crazy.
That seems like a good spot to end. Thanks for coming on, Carter. Really appreciate your insight. Let everyone know your Twitter handle and where all they can find your work.
You can at me at Carter_Shade. You can find my work at fearthesword.com. Busy summer as always, and we're really looking forward to this year at that site. And then if you want to hear more of my dulcet tones with a little side of Winnipeg, you can subscribe to The Chase Down, my podcast with Justin Rowan.
All right. Guys, go subscribe to The Chase Down. Leave it a review and a rating. Do the same for us. We would really appreciate that. Ratings, reviews are great for podcasts. Dan, of course, is on Twitter as well. He's at Dan Favale, F-A-V-A-L-E. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show is at Hardwood Knox. And as always, much to Dan's chagrin, we have to end the show with the shout-out to Bino Udrih.